From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. On the international black market, prices for elephant ivory and rhinoceros horn have reached record highs, and that's pushed wildlife poaching to a fever pitch. Conservationists and governments that profit from wildlife tourism are turning to a high-tech tool to stop the killing, drones. They're doing field tests, and NPR's Christopher Joyce has this story about some early results.
The crowd of wildlife rangers has gathered on a woody hillside in Nepal. A man holds what looks like an overgrown toy airplane in his right hand, arm cocked as if to throw it into the sky. Which is exactly what he does, letting the propeller take charge and send it skyward. The craft is an unmanned aerial vehicle, also known as a drone, though not the military kind. Its wingspan is about 7 feet, and it carries only a video camera. As its electric motor whirs, the camera films the forest below. It's a test run, sponsored and videotaped by the World Wildlife Fund.
It's a cat-and-mouse game when it comes to getting ahead of poachers.
Matt Lewis is a wildlife biologist with WWF. He says poachers are getting more sophisticated.
When poachers are starting to use night vision technology, when poachers are starting to use tranquilizer drugs to silently dart an animal and cut off its horns at night and get out undetected, it's incumbent upon us to find out a better solution to address that.
Lewis says aerial vehicles could tip the odds back in favor of the rangers. So WWF is testing simple, inexpensive ones in Nepal and Namibia in Southwest Africa. Lewis says as the war in Afghanistan winds down, drone manufacturers are looking for new customers. But governments are sensitive about the word drone.
Drone has a very negative context around the world, primarily due to the military use.
But the situation is desperate. In Vietnam, a single rhino horn is now worth a fortune. It's sold as a medicine, even though it's mostly made of keratin, the same stuff as your fingernails. And South Africa is the bank when it comes to rhino horn. Most of the world's rhinos are there, and things are getting out of hand. Kirsty Brebner is a rhino specialist with the Endangered Wildlife Trust in Johannesburg.
Rhino poaching right now is the worst it's ever been. Our rhinos are being absolutely slaughtered.
More than 600 rhinos killed illegally last year out of a total population of 20,000 in South Africa. Brebner says UAVs hold promise. Last month, a sophisticated drone got a week-long trial there, but it's more than just a flying camera.
It's not just launching it into the African night and hoping that you're going to find something. It's actually doing it with mathematics and some sound science behind it.
Math and science is what a team from the University of Maryland brought to the drones versus poachers war in South Africa. They're led by Tom Snitch. Snitch is no wildlife biologist. He's an economist who prefers starched white shirts and business suits to khakis and boots. But Snitch's partners at Maryland use mathematical models to predict behavior. They created a program to help the Pentagon predict where bombers in Iraq and Afghanistan would use IEDs.
And the fact of the matter is, you're looking at human behavior. In that case, IED bombers. In our case, poachers.
Last month, Snitch's team took four drones, made in the U.S. by a company called Falcon, to a South African wildlife reserve. The drones carry infrared and video cameras. They fly themselves. But Africa is big and drones are dumb. That's where the math comes in. The team uses historical records of wildlife movements and poaching to write a computer program that educates the drones.
And you can look at this and say, where should we position our drones to fly at night to intercept these people before they get to the animals? And more importantly, where can you put the rangers between the rhinos and the poachers?
And in the tests, a Falcon drone successfully tracked rhinos and something more.
We put the drone up, and sure enough, right underneath us was a mother and a calf. They were about 75 meters from a fence line, and we saw a car pull up to the fence line and stop.
They reported the car to local rangers, though there was no indication they were poachers. Snitch and the Wildlife Trust's Kirsty Brebner say the trials went well, but they say the ultimate test will be political. If drones catch poachers, will governments prosecute them? Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. The Great Salt Lake in Utah is, as its name suggests, very salty. It also emits a putrid smell and swarms with brine shrimp and flies. Still, this weekend, several dozen people are expected to race in a swimming marathon out on the Great Salt Lake, and some people swim there regularly. NPR's Howard Berkus tells us why.
This is a lake so great it covers 1,700 square miles. It's five times saltier than the ocean with storms that bring surfable waves. It has brine shrimp that swim right into swimsuits and brine flies that fly right into mouths. This Great Salt Lake is the perfect place for a good long swim.
If you can swim here, you can swim pretty much anywhere. You have all the different facets of difficult open water, wide variety of temperatures, wide variety of wind direction, currents, and it's fun.
Surgical technician Stacy Schluckbeer stands in a circle of six swimmers in the parking lot of the Great Salt Lake Marina, about 16 miles west of Salt Lake City. They're all in swimming suits, and they like the open water of reservoirs, lakes, and even oceans. Once a week at least in the fall, winter, and spring, they'll dip into this lake and swim from 400 yards to 6 miles.
It's so huge, and boat traffic is light. On a normal day, you're lucky to even see one boat, so it's a very safe place to swim.
Safe from jet skis and motorboats, says school teacher Goody Tyler. The salt is tough on them, and it's also tough on swimmers. Even the taste stands out, says software developer Gordon Gridley, who swam the English Channel last summer.
The Great Salt Lake was like swallowing a battery, whereas swimming in the ocean was like a glass of lemonade.
And in some ways, the ocean is easier on the swimmers than the lake.
If you swallow the water, that could be potentially hazardous. So you could end up throwing your guts up. And I guess the other main thing is getting chafed. Because it's so salty, it's almost like sandpaper rubbing against you. And it doesn't take long before you start to get blistered up. And in some cases, it's just really, really painful. It burns. So that's why we put the grease on.
The grease is a combination of Vaseline and lanolin. And it glistens on the skin of the swimmers as we talk. They learn to breathe through their nostrils while swimming to avoid inhaling lake water. That also helps with brine flies.
They'll fly right in your mouth and sometimes right down into your lungs, and then you're coughing up not water, but brine flies.
They get so bad in late summer, swimmers take a break from the lake. Still, the nuisances add up to bragging rights, to gnarliness for Salt Lake swimmers.
You're hardcore. When you're out here, you are hardcore. You're not just, you know, just a pool swimmer, or you're just not, you know, just, you're out here, no wetsuit, you're swimming in the salt. You know, it's, you're the real deal.
I think we're going in by the boat ramp, Gord.
And there's nothing hardcore about talking to me in a parking lot. So the swimmers walk down a concrete boat ramp and into the water. Dragging inflated bright orange bags so they're easily spotted by sailboats and each other. The other big attraction for doing this is the setting. A vast and stunning inland sea, framed by snow-capped mountain ranges and its own mountainous islands.
Swim was good. Felt great.
Back at the marina, Goody Tyler rinses off the salt and issues a challenge, a way to send some of what the swimmers experience without actually slipping on a Speedo and joining them.
Go down to the water and just get a handful, put it in your mouth, and then spit it out. Just try it.
Oh. Man, that is salty. Oh.
Oh. You'll never forget it.
I won't.
Ugh, I haven't. It took a gallon of sweet tea to get rid of that skanky taste, which won't deter the marathon swimmers this Saturday. They'll wade in at a brown and jagged island in the distance. It's 8 miles from there to here. That's more than 3.5 hours in the brine, enough to begin the curing process. Last year after the race, the swimmers stuck out their tongues. The most wrinkled, reddened, and pickled flesh won a special prize, a jar of pickles. Howard Berkus, NPR News, at the Great Salt Lake.
Ports on the East Coast are looking forward to late 2014, when the Panama Canal completes its big expansion. On the West Coast, not so much. That's because more goods will be able to bypass Western ports, especially here in Los Angeles. To stay competitive, LA has launched a multi-billion dollar effort to transform the county's sprawling ports into what it calls an international gateway. Now, that project has run into a pair of high-profile lawsuits by environmentalists seeking to halt construction of a $500 million rail yard next to the Port of Los Angeles. NPR's Kirk Ziegler has the story.
Combined, the side-by-side ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles handle almost half of all of the consumer goods shipped into the U.S., and this clearinghouse of globalization takes up a lot of real estate. Drive over the Vincent Thomas Bridge, and stacks of blue and red cargo containers stretch for miles in every direction.
And of course, when you come over the bridge, it is unbelievable. I mean, we have so many terminals here.
Wally Baker's face widens into a big grin as he surveys the panoramic view from a dock at the L.A. Maritime Museum. He can make sense of this overwhelming scene, telling you exactly what each of the skyscraper-sized cranes and trucks and ships are doing here at any moment.
We have a huge amount of capacity, and you would think that's going to be enough. But the reality is, it won't be enough.
Not enough, he says, to compete with a wider Panama Canal that industry analysts say could send about 20% to 30% of the Port of L.A.'s business to the Gulf and East Coast. That's why Baker is spearheading an effort with local unions called Beat the Canal. Job number one is to get a new rail yard built a few miles east of these docks.
That's a big advantage, is that you can take stuff off the ship, have it there in a couple of hours, build the train, go to Chicago, and you don't stop.
Right now, most cargo has to be trucked off-site to rail yards 25 miles away, in some cases further.
Sometimes when the traffic's terrible, we have to drive 3-4 hours, come back from San Bernardino to here, to the L.A. port.
Jose Machuca is one of the thousands of truck drivers who move the freight from the ships to those rail yards every day. He thinks a new rail yard closer in is a good idea because shorter trips would mean fewer hours stuck in traffic and more money in his pocket.
We like to work 8-10 hours a day, but not 14-16. You know, it's a lot.
But where people like Jose Machuca or Wally Baker see commerce and the potential for new jobs, others see a much bleaker scene if the rail yard gets built. There are predictions that the rail yard would add up to 5,000 new truck trips a day here, belching more diesel exhaust into air that's already polluted by ships, power plants, and oil refineries. And that's at the heart of the lawsuits to stop the project.
When something's wrong, you gotta stand up and say, this is wrong, we cannot allow it to move forward.
Angela Logan runs a group called East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice, which is joining with the Natural Resources Defense Council in one of the core challenges. He isn't buying promises that the new rail yard will be a green facility and help reduce pollution.
It's like saying, you know, don't worry about it, it's a cigarette, but it's a filtered cigarette.
Exhibit A for the opposition's case is West Long Beach, which lies just a couple hundred yards from the proposed site. The working-class neighborhood is a mix of African-Americans and immigrants from Mexico. Here, health studies have long found alarmingly high rates of asthma and cardiovascular disease. At the Westside Christian Church on Willow Street, Veronica Guerrero, the wife of the pastor here, says she and her neighbors are well aware of the risks of living downwind of all of this industrial activity.
But on top of that, we have these projects that are trying to get closer to the neighborhoods than they already are, and that really bothers me. That really worries me.
Whether the port can stay competitive is not Guerrero's concern. She says she and many of her neighbors feel powerless. Backers of the rail yard project, she says, can't appreciate their situation.
Even I have heard other arguments like, if you don't like it here, why don't you leave? You know, it's not that easy.
So you've got locals talking about environmental justice and the businessmen and unions talking about economic growth, and both sides have their own studies that show pollution increasing or decreasing if the rail yard gets built. One of the only certainties at this point is that the lawsuits will slow everything down. And back at the Port of L.A., Wally Baker of Beat the Canal says that sends the wrong message.
That it takes 8 years or 12 years to get your project in place, and that somebody can sue you, even though you did everything they wanted to do, you spent $40 million, and then somebody still wants to sue you. That's a really bad message.
Now, even without a court battle, the proposed $500 million rail yard wouldn't be built in time for the expected opening of the widened Panama Canal. That's scheduled for later next year, just about the time L.A.'s project hoped to break ground. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Powerful storms this spring, tornadoes like the ones in Oklahoma, have caused damage estimated in the billions of dollars and dozens of deaths. But does the destruction have to be so devastating? What are the engineering challenges to designing and building stronger, more tornado-resistant structures and providing better protection for the people who live there? David Oprivat is an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Coastal Engineering at the University of Florida in Gainesville and part of a team of engineers that surveyed tornado damage in Moore, Oklahoma, and other places. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Ira.
No, you're welcome. You were testifying before Congress earlier this week on this topic. What were you asking for? What did they want to know?
Well, the main thing that I advocated for is that the American people, we deserve to live in wind hazard resilient communities, and that it is possible for us to do that and get there within 10 years.
It is possible, you're saying, to engineer, design, and build these more wind-resistant.
Absolutely. If we look back at the initiation of tornado research after the Lubbock tornado by Texas Tech Universities in 1971 and Professor Fujita developing his Fujita scale around that time, 40 years have gone by, and the weather systems have improved to the point where we actually have smart weather systems on smart apps on our telephones. And yet, when I looked at the homes in Oklahoma, in Moore, in Tuscaloosa 2 years ago, and in Joplin, I see the same failures of construction details that engineers found in 1971.
Wow. Give us an idea of what they are.
Well, for instance, the main thing I think is missing in all these homes is a continuous vertical load path, one which connects the roof to the wall to the foundation, and everything holding together. If we had this in place, lots of the damage might be reduced. And the main thing I think that's possible for us, Ira, is that catastrophic failure of homes need not be the one way that this has to go. I think we can have homes that are damaged but repairable after an event.
So that you're just not seeing that devastation of somebody sitting on what's left of their concrete porch and nothing else.
Absolutely. I've seen that too often. I've actually seen that in Joplin where folks are having lunch from a picnic basket sitting on the wall of their house, and they've lost everything. The extent of, you know, human suffering that these things cause, it's not just the one event. Mm-hmm. It is a life-changing event for thousands of our families.
Do you need new engineering ideas here? Or are the old ones workable?
Well, I think in part we must start from what we know. And I am at the University of Florida here. In Florida, we know a lot about hurricane-resistant designs. And I think the first thing is to apply those details, hurricane ties and, you know, better construction, better nails, and so on. But beyond that, there are things that we really don't know about tornadoes. We do not know as yet the wind speeds that happen at the ground level, or the effect of this violent suctions that lift roofs off and lift cars up into the air. These things are part and parcel of the science that is really missing, and until such time that we have a number to shoot for, we're really shooting in the dark.
Is anyone doing that research?
Well, I have the good fortune of working on an NSF Career Award myself, entitled Tornado Resilient Communities. And we're sort of scratching the surface here, trying to, first of all, apply what knowledge we know from our wind hazard research here at Florida and all the work that has been done by the emergency management and the building codes here. But beyond that, I'm working with manufacturers of adhesive products and so on to develop new ways, more resistant ways in which we can actually get these buildings held together.
You think some sort of building super glue? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, that's part of it. You know, the thing is we really have to understand that the design that we have at present, we need to turn it on its head, literally. If you take the houses that we build today and just turn them over and have the roof hanging down by gravity, you would see where the failures would occur. It doesn't take a lot of wind load in addition to cause these failures. If we start thinking in those contexts, I think we will be on to a solution.
Mm-hmm. What about shelters?
Well, the shelters, we did actually have an opportunity in Moore to look at some of the schools and the Moore Medical Complex, which was damaged there. Thanks to efforts of our FEMA guides and so on, we were able to get into these buildings. A couple things that I noted with the shelters is, you know, near absolute protection is something that is desired, but in terms of budget, it may not always be there. I think we can do a lot more in terms of the schools, providing roll-up doors or somewhere bracing those corridors in schools so that they're not facing directly to the exterior, and we can protect people's lives there. One of the things I would mention, Ira, is in the Moore Medical Complex, they sheltered 300 people in that shelter during the 20th May tornado with no injuries. This was interesting to us for two reasons. One, they only had 30 patients and staff at the time, so that the majority of these people came from around the area, from homes, from the malls, et cetera, because they wanted to seek shelter for themselves. And this is what will happen with any shelter that one provides in a town or city.
And what was it about the structure of that shelter that made it stay together?
I think it was a bit about the location. Mm-hmm. It was right in the center of the building, and as anyone could see who was traveling on I-35, the building itself was completely damaged on its exterior. But there were several walls protecting this shelter. It probably was hardened, and the corridors themselves were sort of radially, they had several angles and bends and so on. So even though the wind blew out the exterior doors, by the time it got to the entrance of the shelter, it sort of bypassed it and didn't blow into the shelter itself.
Could this be a model for your own home?
Well, I think so. But the thing that one has to recognize with your own home, particularly the smaller homes, is that you need several walls between you and that safe place that you're trying to get to. We saw some of the problems with smaller bungalow-type homes in Joplin and Tuscaloosa 2 years ago, whereby even the interior rooms, you know, they could be places where you would be susceptible to damage.
Now, you were on Capitol Hill where the politicians live. Is this a question of money or a question of politics, or they seem to be the same thing these days?
Yeah. Well, to tell you the truth, I testified with the predecessor of this bill, which was sponsored by Congressman Randy Neugebauer of Texas in, I believe, 2008. And, you know, we're on to the 10th anniversary of when that bill was initiated. I think it's leadership. I think we have to decide once and for all, the one question we need to ask is, do we want to live in wind hazard resilient communities? And if so, what does it take to get there? As I said, I made the comparison today between the 40 years since the Lubbock tornado, when the weather systems have become so far advanced and money has been spent, about $170 million over the last 10 years in better equipment and so on. All of us benefit from this, okay? By the same token, if 40 years ago we spent that type of research and engaged, you know, the enthusiasm and eagerness of, you know, bright graduate students who I have working with me right now, we would have solved this problem. And I think we can still do that now in a 10-year frame, but it requires that sort of, you know, let's go to the moon type of attitude.
Well, what about cost? That going to the moon was expensive. How expensive would this be?
Absolutely. And that's something that we have to really ask each of us what do we want to commit to? Do we want to commit to, you know, providing FEMA with the $2 or $3 billion every 3 years to repair and resuscitate someone's lives, or do we want to build it better the first time? That's a question for each citizen. I think, though, we have to look at the, not only is the cost going to be, you know, explored over a larger area, I think, look at, after we went to the moon, a byproduct of that was the internet.
Right.
You know, so there's going to be several things in which we can benefit as a society.
I have about a minute left. I don't get an idea of that cost. Let's say you have a $100,000 home. How much would it cost you to sink into it to do those things structurally that you're asking to do?
I think I would put in there about $5,000, which would give you hurricane ties, more anchor bolts, larger washers, and metal ties between the wall plates and the studs. I would use more nails, six inch on spacings, ring shank nails, and I think you have a fighting chance after that. Okay. Then you look at putting in a storm shelter, and you protect life safety as well.
Doesn't sound like a whole lot to do. Thank you, Dr. Pravath, very much for your time today.
I really appreciate it, and you have a great day.
You too. David O. Pravath is assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Coastal Engineering at the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida, and part of a team of engineers that surveyed the tornado damage and more in other places. When we come back, we're going to take a break now and talk about genetics, what you need to know about your genome. If you're getting a genome deciphered, it raises a whole slew of ethical questions and practical questions. We'll talk about them when we get back, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
In Southern California, a nuclear power plant that supplied energy to more than a million homes is shutting down for good. As NPR's Ina Jaffe reports, the San Onofre nuclear plant has been idle for repair since January of 2012.
The twin white domes of the San Onofre nuclear power plant have been landmarks on the California coast for more than four decades. That's also made the plant a focus for anti-nuclear protests, like this one last year on the anniversary of the disaster at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan. The oceanfront power plant was updated recently. Brand new generators designed by Mitsubishi Heavy Industries were installed in 2009 and 2010. But very quickly, it became clear that something was wrong. Tubes carrying pressurized radioactive water were wearing out. The generators were finally shut down for investigation and repair when a small amount of radioactive steam escaped and damage was found to be widespread. Several months ago, Edison asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for permission to restart one of the units at 70% power. But there were objections from Senator Barbara Boxer, from local residents, and from the environmental organization Friends of the Earth.
The NRC's own independent judges said, wait a minute, that's an experiment. You've never done that before.
Damon Moglen is director of the organization's climate and energy program.
And our technical people said, that's crazy. You could have a disastrous outcome from running damaged equipment.
Meanwhile, the NRC hadn't ruled. Stephen Conroy, director of communications at Southern California Edison, said the company simply couldn't wait any longer for a response.
To remove the uncertainty of a potentially continuing and protracted decision not coming, we opted to make the announcement that we would decommission the San Onofre nuclear generating station.
Keeping the plant open and ready to start, he said, was costing the company $30 million a month. In the short term, Conroy says Southern California Edison is focused on finding enough power to get California through the summer, replacing the power that San Onofre might have supplied. Last year, the company upgraded transmission and encouraged conservation. They're doing more of that this year.
The challenge is the things that we can't control. Mother Nature, certainly high temperatures, wildfires.
In the longer term, the San Onofre nuclear power generating station will be decommissioned. That will put more than 1,000 employees out of work, and the process will take years. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
Thank you.
You've heard the expression, bright lights, big city. For many people, city living can mean long hours at work and play and never enough sleep. Now, a new study suggests that cities can have a very similar effect on another group of residents, birds. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports.
Since the 1930s, scientists have noticed that birds in cities, like robins and starlings, can keep different hours than their relatives in forests. Barbara Helm is a biologist at the University of Glasgow.
If you walk through a forest at, say, 4 a.m, it would be just dead quiet. And if you walk through the city, you would just already hear all these birds singing.
But she says no one knew whether all this pre-dawn singing reflected a permanent change in the daily rhythms of urban birds. And that's what Helm and her colleagues decided to investigate in their study on one species, the European blackbird.
They used to be a relatively shy forest bird until about a couple of hundred years ago. And now they're like a totally ubiquitous city bird, and they live even in the inner business districts of cities.
Including cities like Munich, where she and her team conducted the study. They compared the city birds with those living in a nearby forest.
This was a forest some 20 miles outside Munich.
Helm's colleague, Davide Dominoni, is at the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology. He went out and captured 6 birds each in the city and in the forest. And on each bird, he attached a tiny radio.
That is just a simple radio, which gives an impulse, a radio impulse, every 3 seconds. It's like a do, do, do.
Any changes in the strength of that signal meant that the bird was moving. An unchanged signal meant that the bird was sitting still or asleep. So by looking at the signals around dawn and nightfall, Dominoni figured out when the birds woke up and when they went to bed. It turns out that the forest birds woke up at the crack of dawn, but their city cousins were up well before.
The birds in the city of Munich, they were waking up approximately half an hour earlier than the birds in the rural forest.
And they went to bed a good 6 minutes later. So in all, these city birds also slept about 40 minutes less each day. And when the scientists brought back 14 city and 14 forest birds to their lab and kept them all under the same conditions, the city birds still woke up earlier, suggesting that their body clocks had become programmed to run at a faster pace. The results of the study were published in the latest proceedings of the Royal Society. Biologist Steve Nowicki of Duke University says this is probably a common phenomenon.
I bet that what's happening to blackbirds is happening to every species that is exposed to, you know, urban disruption.
The urban disruption, he says, is probably city lights, which mess with the body's sense of day and night. Because light controls how our and other animals' bodies calculate day length. And
birds in particular are extremely attuned to day length.
Nowicki says in humans, bright city lights change body clocks and disrupt sleep patterns, which in the long run can affect our health. But whether there are negative impacts on urban animals, that's hard to tell, he says. Blackbirds seem to thrive in cities, but other species, he says, may find it harder to handle the faster urban clocks. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.